is CoDiscovery. Hello, welcome to this episode of CoDiscovery with me, Abigail Acton. Are you a stargazer? Maybe you're a beachcomber. Or perhaps you care about traffic pollution in your neighborhood. Enthusiasts, people with hobbies and spare time, or concerned about their environment, you and me. All of us are potential collectors of data and information that can add a dimension to research projects. With over 2.5 million volunteers using the Zooinverse Citizen Science app, the movement is clearly gaining momentum. Why involve the general public in data collection and research? How do you get them on board and keep them motivated? Does participation empower people? And can projects gain their own momentum, carrying on after the funding ends? If you're into the idea of counting killer whales around the Aleutian Islands from the comfort of your living room, or if you're a scientist keen to make the most of the resource a network of motivated volunteers can bring, listen on. To discuss citizen science engagement and empowerment are our three guests, whose work has been funded under the EU's Horizon 2020 programme. Xavier Basaranga is Associate Professor at the Barcelona Institute for Global Health. Xavier has a background in biostatistics. His research covers the health effects of environmental exposure with a special focus on air pollution. Welcome, Xavier.
Hello.
Professor of Environmental History at the University of Stavanger in Norway, Finn Arne Jørgensen studies the evolution of human relationships with nature over time and place. He's particularly interested in how technology enables and mediates these relationships. Hello, Finn Arne.
Hey, Abigail. Good to be here.
Nice to have you. Chris van Herle is a transport policy researcher working at Transport and Mobility Leuven, a spin-off of the University of Leuven in Belgium. Chris is interested in citizen science in the context of transport policy. He started the Telram project and co-founded Rear Window. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Abigail. Hi, all.
Xavier, I'm going to turn to you first. The City's S Health project is interested in evaluating the health impacts of urban living. Your project wanted to encourage collaboration between researchers and citizens to generate solid, unbiased scientific evidence. Sounds like a nice ambition. There have been quite a few projects that have set out to measure the impact of urban living on people's health. What gaps were you seeking to fill through your project?
Well, actually, it's true that if we restrict it to citizen science projects, there have been several projects that, in which citizens measure air pollution with different devices. But actually, there are not many that also measure a health outcome and try to make the connection, the relationship between air pollution and health. So I think in this sense, cities health was quite novel in the citizen science world. And I think this is important because, for example, many times we don't perceive that air pollution is affecting us individually. And once we do this kind of studies where we start collecting and gathering data from many citizens, then some patterns emerge. And we see that those living in the most polluted areas or on the days with more air pollution, we see worse health outcomes.
Uh-huh.
So to me, it was important that citizens were able to see that even if they don't perceive that air pollution is affecting them, it might be affecting them.
Interesting. So it's also raising awareness amongst the population of the possible impacts as well.
Yes. And I think just because many people ask, how do you do this? How do you know that is air pollution that is affecting health?
And yeah. How do you make the link?
Yes.
Yeah.
So for example, in the citizens in Barcelona decided to study if air pollution affected their ability to concentrate. But this is affected by many other things, like how you sleep that day, or maybe you have something else that was worrying you. So citizens were raising all these points and providing feedback, and then we were trying to incorporate and to control that in our study.
But that sounds absolutely fascinating. I love that example. That's a really interesting example, but you're right, because there's so many different things that could be mediating on that. So how exactly did you measure that? What did the citizens do in order to record the correlation between the pollution and their ability to concentrate?
So we asked participants to participate during 2 weeks, and every day they were answering a survey in a phone. But interestingly, when we were preparing the study, citizens were concerned that actually using questionnaires is too subjective, no? And they felt that if we just use questionnaires, the results would not be valid or there could be bias. So, and they insisted a lot on that. So, and that's why one of the reasons why we included cognitive tests as well, which is a more validated tool. And they were in the end answering these cognitive tests every day during 2 weeks. And we were comparing if on the days with more air pollution, the results were worse than on the cleaner days.
And were they?
Yes, they were. So in the end, we just published the results of the study. And we showed that on the more polluted days, citizens perform 5% worse than on the more clean days. And they also reported more stress during the high polluting days.
So that's very interesting. And how many people were taking part in that particular element? Because I know your project looked at other dimensions and you were active in other places as well. But this particular case study, how many people did you have involved?
Well, we had different phases and we had a different number of people involved in the different phases. Some collaborated in the design. Some were just voting the research question. So there were around 1,000 citizens involved. But then in the actual study, there were 300 that provided these answers every day for 2 weeks.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that's really impressive. You've got 1,000 people motivated to take part in this one case study. You had other case studies ongoing as well. And you had 300 people who were prepared to take part in a daily activity. So that leads me very nicely on to the next question, which I think is the one that comes to everybody's minds listening to this. How do you get people involved at that level and how do you keep them motivated? Because those numbers are good numbers.
Well, we did these workshops with citizens where I think they were very happy to contribute to the design of the study. Then we had a strong communication campaign as well. We had a newsletter with casual language and trying to explain interesting things about the project in a very short way as well. And then I think one of the things that also work is providing participants some physical thing. So for example, we were sending them a box with our research kit. I think just receiving a box attracts their attention, and then they had a tube to measure NO2, a booklet with instructions, a door reminder that don't forget your tube today. So I think this kind of things also contribute a bit that people get more excited about the project.
Absolutely. It's bringing out the inner child almost. Yes. It's like a Christmas present, like, you know, when you used to get a sort of science kit when you were a kid, maybe at Christmas or something. That sounds great. How did you find the people in the first place? I mean, how did you recruit? Did you just start advertising in local newspapers? How did you get out there in the first place?
We did several things. We did some, for example, we started with a pop-up intervention in the 10 districts of the city. We were in the streets. We were actually giving strawberry plants to people as a way, well, we used that also to measure air pollution. But it was basically an opportunity to talk about the project and to get some publicity. We were in the media. Then we ran this online campaign also with videos and just to publicize the project and get the interest of the citizens.
Yeah, get people to enroll. I like the idea of the strawberry plants. Again, it's something very real. Excellent. Thank you. Thank you very much for telling us about that. I know your project was involved with other case studies as well, but I think it's nice to have one concrete little case study where we can see actually how it panned out. We're aiming this podcast episode at people who are curious about taking part in citizen science projects, but also at researchers who are interested in setting them up. So if you had one takeaway for a researcher who was listening to this and thinking, that sounds like a good way to access a lot of accurate, personalized data, what would you say would be the one thing that they need to take on board when they're designing this approach?
I think that the time availability of the people is a very important factor. We were discussing that with citizens when we designed the study, and they insisted, let's design something that I just need to spend 5 or 10 minutes per day. And this, I can afford it. And I think that many people will be also able to participate. Many times we want citizens to do a lot of things, but I think that the time is the issue. Even the more motivated ones, sometimes they don't have the time to contribute with all the things that they would like to.
Yeah, so I think realistic expectations. So it sounds like what you're saying is a quirky publicity approach, the notion of something solid in someone's hands that they have to open and unwrap and figure out. The strawberry plant concept is quite a good one too, I think, huh? And then, as you say, keeping your expectations realistic. Thank you very, very much, Xavier. That was fascinating. Okay, I'm going to turn to Finn Arne now. The citizen part of the phrase citizen science was the focus of the EnviroCitizen project. Finn Arne, your project wanted to understand the ways in which citizen science projects can be used to cultivate new ways of thinking and acting in all aspects of life and to promote environmental sustainability. You were interested, I think, in seeing if people participating actively with their environment would change the way that they think about it. So how did you test that idea? Can you tell us a little bit about how the project worked?
Sure, I can do that. I guess the first thing to point out is that being interested in the role of the citizen and how people participate in citizen science projects and how that influences their way of being, it builds on the project team's background in humanities and social science research mostly. We have some people in education as well. So we come into this with this angle, trying to understand, well, the culture aspect, the community aspect of this too. And in that process, also understanding in some ways where citizen science as a practice comes from. So that's in a way where we started. And it's a thing that's kind of challenging to test empirically, especially in this hard science way. So what we did is, we knew we wanted to look at this idea of citizenship, and there were many cases we could have done it through. And we went through a couple of different ideas in these initial stages of developing the project, and we ended up with birds and bird watching for several reasons. One is that this is one of the oldest, citizen science practices. This is where some of these practices started, even though the idea of who was a citizen who counted was very different than at the beginning ornithology. And then you can use this example of birdwatching to trace the development over time. You can also, this is what I found was one of the really fascinating things, is the way birdwatching as a practice can be found anywhere. Birds are anywhere in Europe. They are in the cities, in the countryside. You have some of the same birds that either just exist in the same places, or you have migrating birds who go between different places in Europe. So we have in our project, then we're 7 European partners. We spread all over Europe, so north, south, east, west, looking at the birds then and how people engage with birds around Europe.
Okay, and how people engage with birds around Europe being also a kind of barometer with how they engage with the natural world more widely, I suppose.
Yeah, so one of the things that we've found then is that it, being actively engaged in birdwatching, it's kind of this ladder, right? Because it's a very low threshold activity to get into. And a lot of people did during COVID as well, when during the lockdowns, birdwatching saw this huge boom, both like in-person bird watching, but also virtual bird watching and so on. So what we saw then is through participation, through gaining knowledge and observing birds, and particularly like thinking about birds over time. Birds, they shift across the seasons, but if you engage in bird watching over longer times, you actually see that there's less of some birds and there are more other birds. So we see that people start questioning, why is this? What are the relationships and the developments in society that lead to changes in bird populations? And what can we do about it? So this idea of care has actually ended up being very central in our project. It's one way of understanding nature values, this idea we can and should care for nature in particular, very concrete ways. It's not a abstract care, but it's very specific. And I think that is powerful.
Yeah, so why aren't there more thrushes in my back garden? Where have my thrushes gone? Yeah, I get that. But what I'm curious to know is, was it not possible that your cohort was self-selecting? In other words, I mean, was it not possible that the subjects were already people who were keen birders? What did you do to try and bring in people who'd never thought of birdwatching as a pastime that could interest them at all?
So one of the things we did was to do a lot of interviews. So we have, and again, in our seven countries where we've had teams working, they have joined birdwatching tours. So in a way, become part of these communities that we are studying also. And through those, met people, interview them, make sure that we got a very good distribution, you know, from the people who've been doing birdwatching for 50 years, like the very hardcore twitchers sit ready with their phone and they get a message when there's this rare bird and they all run out into their cars to go see them. Two people who just took it off because, oh, they sounded interesting. So that's one. Of course, I see your point about this self-selecting. Of course, you won't get people who do not watch birds this way. So one of the other things we did was we've been working with school children through teachers in particular. I mean, it's a bit challenging to work directly with school children also for privacy reasons as well. There are very strict rules about that, and I get that. So, but we've been working with teachers as well then to reach kids. And what we see, I mean, bird watching in these activities around watching and counting and thinking about birds, there are so many ways to engage with these larger goals in natural curricula for school, you know, that the kinds of knowledge and values and skills that that we want children to develop in school. And many of these children do not have particular relationship with birds. I guess another thing we saw was, I mean, it's not uncommon for children to be interested in birds, to notice birds and to think about them and talk about them. But there's something that happens when they come into the teenage years where they're less interested. Some of these people come back when they get older, but not all. So that's also one of these areas or phases in life we identified where here might actually be possible to design some interventions. You know, how can you keep the teenagers interested in birds? I guess also, what is it about those teenagers who remain interested in birds? What is it that keeps them interested?
Yeah, and yes, what can you learn from that and maybe apply to the ones who are becoming disengaged? Okay, that's super. There's a clear benefit for the participants in terms of awareness of the natural environment and getting outdoors and so on. But I think you were also interested in the benefit to nature of this kind of activity. Did you notice any changes with how people interacted with the environment? Was it more respectful?
Yeah, I don't know if I want to call it just a respectful. It's kind of a different...
Aware, maybe?
Aware, certainly. And there is, again, this development of care, which shows... I mean, we tied this to this idea of citizenship or environmental citizenship. It's a term that's gaining increasing traction. And we have it from one of the another EU-funded cost network, this European project that developed this then, which looks at both rights and responsibilities that people have in relation to nature. And we are then also moving away from this idea of citizenship as something connected to states, nations, you know, membership in some particular group that way, to being citizens of the planet, with this particular kind of relationship. And one of the things we see is that developing environmental citizenship is something that is transformative. It is not just, oh, you have, you know, you accumulate a little bit more knowledge, but in this process, something happens then, some change in the way you relate to and care about the planet. But we are measuring this impact on people and their values, not on the environment itself.
Of course.
So some of these effects you won't see until years down the line.
Well, of course, because the people's behavior towards their environment that will cause the environment to benefit, and that does take time to unfold. But it is a win-win for both. Uh-huh. Does anyone have any comments at all for Finan, any observations?
Yeah, actually, I have one. Super interesting. I'm a bird watcher myself, so very, very interested to hear this talk. I was curious, are these citizen science observations, are they useful for doing species population estimates or selection bias an issue? I can see that birds of prey are more popular with bird watchers, so you might see some issues there. I'm curious.
Yeah, I mean, and that's one of the really interesting things that come with this lowered threshold, that it's very easy for people to get into this first level. And part of that is done because of the development of this platform. So you have apps where you register bird observations. And many of these can just be very common birds. You have the backyard bird count that you do across Europe in January, where you just basically register what kind of birds are in your garden. They are super common birds. There's, in a way, in and of it themselves, not particularly exciting or interesting as observations, but in this being such a widespread and popular activity, you can then trace actually larger patterns across Europe. And then, I mean, the more into these apps people are, you do get a lot of registration. So there's a lot of data about what kinds of birds are in, they're active in particular areas. So there's, of course, a lot of knowledge, I mean, good science generated through these activities as well.
Also, it's public engagement. I mean, it's like a gateway activity to perhaps something bigger at another time. Savia, you have a question.
So I was wondering if you were interested in really getting people that will get into birdwatching, like from now on, or you have some sporadic users also that they just tried that for some time and then they leave it, but maybe still it's a benefit for them to know how this thing works.
I think that's one of the beauties of bird watching as a practice, in that it works at so many of these different levels. And I mean, there are kind of like these plateaus where you can gain knowledge to begin with really quickly, but then it takes a bit to get to the next level, right? Because I mean, there are some people who are incredibly dedicated, and their knowledge of birds is like almost magical, in that they can see, like, you know, this tail sticking out from some bushes up there and know exactly what kind of bird it is. But most people will never reach that level because it requires so much time and effort. And that's not why people are doing it. Whereas for other people, of course, spending this time and effort is precisely why they're doing it, because it's so rewarding to them.
Yeah. Excellent. So I think you hit on a really good sort of, I'm trying to find the right word, really, a good means of opening up a range of possibilities for people to engage in. You're right. I mean, everyone can do it, and everyone can do it either a little or everyone can do it a lot, depending on what they actually feel motivated to do. Excellent. Thank you very much, Xavier. That's fascinating. Chris, I'm going to turn to you. WeCount wanted to give people the tools they needed to monitor traffic, to co-design solutions to tackle a variety of road transport challenges. You were particularly interested in empowering people to collect the data they needed to approach their local authorities. So we've talked about engagement a little bit just now, and now I'm turning to the notion of empowerment a little as well. You combined your experience as a transport policy researcher and consultant with your interest in citizen science. So what did you hope to achieve?
Yeah, excellent. Okay, where to start?
That's a good sign.
Well, to start off, I'm a transport policy specialist. Data is my food, so we need a lot of data to do this analysis. Typically, we buy traffic counting data, either floating car data, point counts, or whatever. But at the same time, these data are expensive. So traffic counting data typically is just hugely expensive. If you want these pneumatic tubes, you're very quickly in order of magnitude of 1,000 euros or something for just one site. It's just very expensive. And at the same time, as a transport policy specialist, we also engage with citizens sometimes. And we could see that people were counting manually, and sometimes traffic counting manually. And actually, this information was useful for analysis, but it's scattered. It's just one off. So I'm a citizen science enthusiast myself. So I see what the potential. I'm a citizen science volunteer. So I participate on a citizen science project. And I was thinking, let's try this concept for traffic counts. So let's try to give a citizen a tool so they can generate the data which is actually being used. So let's give them something where they can generate data which is useful for traffic policy. And that basically was the scope for WeCount.
Okay, I get that. So let's start from the beginning. How did I'm curious again? How did you reach out and enroll people? How did you get people on board?
Yeah, well, we worked with an open call. Basically, we used local communication channels. We always had a very confined geographical areas. We had five case studies: Leuven in Belgium, Barcelona, Madrid, Cardiff, Dublin, and Ljubljana. So we used the local communication channels to tap in and say, okay, dear citizen, do you want to count traffic? You can join this project and you'll get a sense of, woohoo, very nice. And that in itself is enough. So we had more than enough volunteers who were willing to host this sensor, because that's the commitment that the citizen science had to do. At the very least, you have to install the sensor in your place, do a bit of effort, but then you're collecting and counting traffic on your specific location.
So I guess, again, then that's quite interesting, because we're going back a bit to Xavier's idea of receiving a box through the post and having something solid in your hand that makes you feel that you've got something to contribute. So that's an interesting overlap that both of you have come across there. Okay. And so you had more people volunteering than you needed. I mean, you had as many as you needed. I guess also you were pressing a button a bit, because a lot of people are concerned, rather like Xavier's project on pollution, people are concerned about traffic in their environments. So I guess they were quite hungry to participate. Okay. Yeah. And so you sent them equipment. What equipment did you send, and what did you ask them to do with it, please?
Yeah, so it's a low-cost traffic counting sensor. Basically, it's a Raspberry Pi-based system. So Raspberry Pi is a common microcomputer available in large volumes. We tweaked it. We made a bit of software so it could count, or it could be pointed towards the street so it can collect traffic counting data. And the commitment from our participants is to self-install this thing. So that's where it competes, or how it stands off compared to different technologies. So these pneumatic tubes or high-end camera systems have to be installed in situ by technicians. Expensive again. But while if you go for something low-cost, simple, your citizens become your technician, and they will do it for free because they are committed. They want to know traffic in their street. So this is the quid pro quo, let's say. So a citizen makes a bit of an effort for generating or setting up the sensor, because it takes a bit of time. It's a bit technical. But they will get traffic counting data for their street, which is in their interest as well.
Okay. And how did they report back, or did the sensor automatically, I guess the sensor automatically reported the data back to you? Did they have to do, my question really is, did they have to do anything beyond installing the sensor? What else did they have to do?
Yeah, this is where it becomes interesting, because when I started the project, it was my first citizen science project when to set up, and my only interest was, okay, I want to have this data. I want to have it so I can do my analysis, which is this data, which is otherwise way too expensive. But then the beautiful thing becomes part. So the citizens who have their sensor, they're super engaged. And so they're super curious about what this data that they're generating is meaning for them. They start to do their own analysis. They start to find insights in the traffic counting data, which you wouldn't even see yourself. There's this beautiful example, which I've used a million times. I was analyzing data once, and I saw a big spike in traffic, on bike traffic on 11 a.m., which makes no sense. You see a bike peak in the morning and the evening. And then when I was in a workshop, then somebody explained, well, there's a group of cyclists, a club, we always take the same itinerary, always at the same time. So only they can explain this type of phenomenon. And that's the nice thing. So give these tools to citizens and they will start analyzing and find insights which you as an expert would not even have found.
Excellent. No, that sounds fascinating. And thinking about empowerment, I mean, you were giving them the tools they needed in order to get hard data. Did you find that they then themselves wanted to go further with that, maybe approach policymakers or maybe raise questions amongst the, you know, to local councillors or, yeah, tell me.
Yeah, for sure. It would, like you said, traffic is a hot topic and local traffic is a hot topic. So we actually have a selection bias in our participants. You have people who are very committed and very engaged to traffic issues, who often already have some kind of line of communication open with their local policy level. There's being speeding in my street, or the one-way street is not being respected, or there's trucks, well, there shouldn't be anyone here. So apart from the pure hardcore data, we also try to give them some tools how to start engaging with a discussion with the local authority. I think that's what we try to make a difference with Telehelps, with the technology, is trying to make this bridge. The data is objective. Both the policymaker, the local authority, and the citizen have to agree on the data. This is a problem or it's not.
It's a fact. Yeah.
It's a fact, exactly. And it can, issues which are typically antagonistic, like which can be very divisive, can then start opening up a conversation around the data which is being generated by the citizen. So, yeah, you have to try to make this bridge, I think, between the policy level and the citizen.
Absolutely. And I guess that whole point about the antagonism, I mean, that really, I that kind of divisive conversation, I can imagine, does take place all the time. But when you've actually got hard data that the facts speak for themselves, I guess you take a lot of the heat out of the conversation, because it just is what it is and nobody can try and pretend it isn't. Yeah.
Yep. Absolutely. We've actually seen both issues. So you have citizens who are very activistic joining the project and have very strong opinion about an issue in their street. Data shows that it's maybe not that big of an issue, and a street just across the street, let's say, is having a major issue. So it helps calm down these, very vocal citizens.
Yeah.
But vice versa as well. Eh? So you might emerge issues which you didn't know were there, and then you might create an issue. So it's not always that easy for local authorities they're not always super eager to open up this Pandora box because it might backlash for them as well.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely fascinating. I'm really enjoying this. This is such a great conversation. Does anybody have anything that they want to ask Chris or any points or observations? Xavier, yes, please.
No, I think, traffic is very related to pollution, so we have the similar issues. And one is basically where you measure. No, it is very important where you measure. For example, with air pollution, we have the official monitoring stations that they are located in some places, but there might be citizens that live in some other places where the concentrations are much higher. So I wonder if it happens the same with traffic, and if in your data you find things that were not in the official traffic data.
Yes, I would position Telegram or WeCount as a complementary to high-end traffic counting techniques. So you will not want to measure high-end roads like the big roads because you will have, it's worth paying money there to have high-end technology. But it's in these small residential areas which are often forgotten, which are then also very often the victim of this cut-through traffic. It's complementary. So we're actually filling a blind spot.
It's like missing pieces of the jigsaw. Yeah, exactly. And you guys have both got projects ongoing in Barcelona, so you should stay in touch because you overlap. Finani, you had a question. What was your question?
Yeah, I think this is one that really addresses all of us because it's fascinating. Birds, traffic, and pollution. I mean, they're found everywhere where people are. So, they're also very good cases for
engagement.
Engagement and studying people. But of course, people can be quite difficult to relate to. We've used terms like citizens, we use terms like policymakers, there are also people, stakeholders is another one, and there are also communities of people. And then there's us who are, we are scientists, we're researchers, we are studying them in particular ways. So I guess this is a question for both of you. What has your relationship to those people you are studying been? Have there been negotiations of authority and trust in that process? Did you have to work hard to make people trust you?
So, Xavier, I'm going to ask you to answer that and then and afterwards, Chris.
Well, I must say we were working on a topic that already has a lot of people that are concerned, and we know that our participants were basically people who already care about air pollution and they were worried about that. So in that sense, they were very happy to participate in the study and to have this connection with citizens because then they felt that someone was helping them or was trying to improve this particular problem.
Mm. And Chris, you were involved with sort of communicating with different members of the community. So perhaps your question, Finano's question, is maybe a little bit more relevant for you. Did you have trust issues? How did you navigate that?
That's a super good question. The way I've come to understand the citizen science ecosystem, let's say, is that you need some anchor points within the local community who act as your local champion, let's say, who are your conveyors of trust. If you should invest time with this relationship. But if you have made clear that what you are trying to offer is helping everybody, then they will sell your solution towards the volunteers in the end. So I think this type of three-step approach, let's say, like we as a scientist at the very, very top have let's say, intense communication with a few local heroes, the way you want to call them, and then have a whole bunch of underlying volunteers who basically put their trust in these in the intermediate level. That works for us, at least.
Can I add a question to all of you, really? Have you noticed that since the pandemic, I'm suddenly thinking of this myself, I have a wonderful Streets WhatsApp group. I know that some people's Streets WhatsApp group can be problematic. Ours is just lovely, I have to say. It's a really good community. Have you noticed that since the pandemic, because people started to communicate with their neighbors through WhatsApp to just get through the whole situation, that has opened up a new channel for reaching people? Or might it be going forward?
Yeah, I'd like to answer first if I can, because our project was right in the middle of the pandemic. So our first case study was right in the middle of the pandemic. So we had to completely reorient our engagement strategy. We had everything in workshops and face-to-face, but we had to move something online. And it's been an issue because I think you lose people if you don't have a physical engagement with them. So they're not that engaged. But your reach is bigger. I mean, you have digital reach, so you can get to more people who were maybe before weren't that digitally active and then had to become because of the pandemic. And then you can reach people who you could otherwise not have been reaching. So it's got two sides of the same medal, I'd say.
I've just thought of a third as well. I mean, because people became more digitally active, perhaps they were less frightened, if I can say that in inverted commas, about the idea of trying to install a Raspberry Pi, because computers became part of everyday life. And so somebody says, could you set up this little mini computer? It's like, you know, they become perhaps more aware that they can. Finn Arne.
I mean, our experience has been very undigital in that sense, because our project started April 2020. I mean, it was the worst possible timing. But at the same time, we had designed the project well, because the first part of the project was we were going to understand in a way where this practice came from, the historical background and so on. So that worked pretty fine for the first time then. But then when we started up doing like participant observation, working with communities, it also worked well because, you know, people went outside to do bird watching. So outside walks to do and guided walks to do bird watching continued throughout the pandemic. So that part was, undisturbed mostly, it even got more popular because people were interested in getting out. But you did see also a big boost in these various birding apps. People downloaded them and started using them.
Yeah, looking for alternative sort of areas of stimulation because their normal areas were taken away from them, I guess.
Exactly. I can't say much about WhatsApp and if it's being used. We do not have a street WhatsApp. There's a neighborhood Facebook group, but it's like, oh, I found a lost bike here. Have you seen my cat? And that's it's very dead.
I was sitting in the garden about 6 months ago and a macaw, I'm in Brighton in the UK, a macaw flew, touching distance above my head. I thought, okay, where am I? What country am I actually in? And it was being mobbed by seagulls. And they were really giving it a hard time. And it was through the streets WhatsApp group that we discovered someone had lost a macaw and it was returned. So, you know, bird watching really made dynamic. Okay. Yes, please. One more question from Xavier or observation. Please, Xavier.
Also that our project was also in the middle of COVID. And apart from the electronic channels to communicate with the citizens, I think one other thing that changed, at least in Barcelona, is that people were more used to having things delivered at home. So, for example, in the past, we would say, okay, you can pick your research kit here in our institute, and they have to come, and they have to find the time to come. But now, we designed a strategy where we delivered the kits with bike messengers. And Since people were more used to receive many things.
We got a little lazier in some ways.
But I think also may help in some of the new studies.
Absolutely, because it's, you know, it's a bit of a turnoff to think, oh, I've got to trek all the way down there and get this stuff. And it just arrives at the door. It's like a gift. Fantastic. Okay, listen, thank you very much, the three of you. I really, really enjoyed that.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks a lot, Abigail. Thanks for having us.
Thanks. Bye.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye. If you are interested in seeing what the EU is doing to promote citizen science, take a look at the eu-citizen.science platform, which gathers projects together. It gives anyone interested in setting up a project involving the public ideas on how to make the whole thing work. To see what other EU-funded projects are doing to involve citizens in their work, visit the CORDIS website. This will give you an insight into the results of projects funded by the Horizon 2020 program that are working in this area. The website has articles and interviews that explore the results of research being conducted in a very broad range of domains and subjects. From stars to starfish, there's something there for you. Maybe you're involved in a project or would like to apply for funding. Take a look at what others are doing in your domain. So come and check out the research that's revealing what makes our world tick. We're always happy to hear from you. Drop us a line, editorial@cordis.europa.eu. Until next time.